to an organization a couple of years old, headed by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin in Israel, Rabbi Efrat, or the former Rabbi Efrat, talking about apologetics to Christianity, and a number of statements that really, I'm not the only one to address it and to reject it, but it's unfortunate how people with big names that are popular, they're at the forefront of Jewish education, are making really grave and heretic compromises to other religions, and now not standing up for the truth. Now it hurts themselves, it hurts Jews, and it hurts others that are not being shown the truth. And like God says in the Torah, that when the other nations see us keeping the Torah properly, they'll say, what a wise and understanding people this great nation is. Now they can't have that impression of us if we're obscuring or compromising clear, pure Torah principles. And again, fear of people or other considerations are propelling people to be accepting of doctrines and other religions that are completely antithetical to the Bible, to the Torah. And that's the purpose of the book. God's Only Religion says it as clear as possible, that there are no alternatives. And we'll touch on that when we get to the second segment, which is other religions, what the problems are, whether invalid and fabricated and heretical. And Elisa, if you have the sound well, I'm glad that link was available for you. Okay, so why don't we commence? So again, my name is Rabbi Moshe Ben Chaim. I just published a new book, The Bible, God's Only Religion. I hope that this is very enlightening for people. It's not apologetic at all. It's pure presentation of the Bible, of God's Torah, authentic Judaism given at Sinai. Now, the first part of the book, what I address is emotional bias and incorrect notions that people have. Because in order to have truth, like Maimonides says, you can't teach a person who's immoral or caves to his emotions. You can't teach a person like that. Because, as he says, when they hear an idea that goes against their emotions, so they reject it. So their mind is not objective. Their mind is not open to hearing truth, let alone following it. And there are a number of emotional biases when you're coming from other religions or even from a non-religious life. And one emotional bias, of course, is viewing the established religions and in all of their ornate garb and beautiful houses of worship and the history and the books and the antiquity of other religions. This tends to give a person a sense that it's real, that it's true, that it's valid. But a person has to see clearly that religions are in conflict, so they cannot all be correct. They argue on each other. So a person has to be objective and has to be in control of their emotions and check their biases at the door if they're going to learn anything, not just about religion. And again, primarily, the problem is that people view religion different than other areas. I mean, people will be very accurate and look for and proof for when they go for a job interview. And they'll make sure that everything is in a signed contract. And they'll use their intelligence to make sure that their employer is equipped to pay them the salary that they're asking, that they're established, that they're not wasting their time. And when a person hires other people, the same thing. They do a background check, and they use intelligence. And when you go to a doctor, you don't just let any person do surgery on you. There's a lot of investigation and validation and speaking to people and who've been treated, and they look for the success, and not just one success, but they want to see an overall success of the doctor. Now, in all these areas, using intelligence, which of course is the proper thing to do, you want to live by truth, so you have to validate anything that you invest your time in, your health, and colleges for your children, and so on. Religion is no different. Unfortunately, it's been accepted. It's like the unspoken rule that religion is subject to belief. It's not something which is subject to proof, to reason. And that's a baseless statement. And unfortunately, what other religions have done in order to propel their mission, since they were not based on reason, and they were based on actually very irrational and heretic ideas, they would force people by the sword to convert. And you see that happening today with ISIS. So it's something which is age old. So these are a number of biases that people have. Again, the antiquity of religion that's established, that there's so many books and there are so many followers. I mean, there are so many billions of people that are following ideas that are just not valid. But what is comforting to see is that there are a number of people who defect from the other religions because they see, they use their minds. And it's those few people that are not following the crowd that are benefiting by realizing that the Bible itself is the only word of God. You see as well that the other religions, the major religions, Christianity and Islam, that they adopt the entire Old Testament or the Bible. Reason being is because it's as valid as any other historical event. So they realize that they can't dispute it. But what they did was they violated God's rules, his laws, in the Bible. One of the 613 commands is not to add or subtract from the Bible, from the Torah. Yet they do that, they create a New Testament, and they create a Quran. And they do not adhere to the very words that they have adopted. So they're internally conflicting. They contradict themselves in their very practice of writing additional statements and creating stories that were never witnessed. And of course, you understand the unique difference between all of the religion and Judaism is that Judaism is the one religion, that is witnessed by masses. And this is completely absent in every other religion. And it makes sense because when God gave a religion, he knew the future. And he didn't feel that there's any updated needed. Just like man doesn't change, the religion wouldn't need to change. We don't see that there's any difference in the food that God provides for the entire humankind, because the body, man's body, hasn't changed. So everything which was necessary from Adam the first to today, 5,700 years later, is still applicable. The same organs need the same nutrients, and therefore food has not changed. Well, the same goes in terms of a person's soul, his mind. There's no change. There was no new reinvention of man. So there's no need for a new update. So this throws a very big rejection against all the other religions. Because what they're saying is that something was unforeseen and now there needs to be a change. And of course their attempted changes and their stories are in conflict with themselves, numerous gospels, and their religions themselves are just skin deep. There's nothing below the surface. You just read the statement and you're supposed to accept it like dogma. And that's what it is. In contrast, we have a written Torah and we have an oral Torah. And without that, which were both given at Sinai, you can't understand and interpret what it means. So when it says in the Torah that a person's hand should be cut off, you need the oral law to tell you that it means monetary value, not a barbaric act. So that's a real necessity. But the core issue is that there's no validity to the claims. There were no mass witnesses. So if a person comes along and tells you today that God spoke to him, and you see this on TV, you see these preachers, and they go into these trances, these phony trances, and as if they believe that they know somebody in North Dakota that suffered from cancer, and they say they're healed, and just to have belief in Jesus. And if you want to believe this person, fine. There's no way to show he's right or wrong. But that's the method that's been used. A claim is made, and hundreds of years after the fact, in terms of Christianity, claims are made that certain things, certain miracles have taken place, but there's no validity. So if a person wants to believe that's their prerogative, and God wants people to have free will in order to use it and not to be coerced, which is what the other religions do. But if a person wants proof, then they should look for the same proof they find in any type of historical event. And that is where there are masses involved, And this removes any type of ability for the story to have been fabricated. For example, if a person would tell you today that they were on the George Washington Bridge at rush hour, and that some spaceship came down and gave this person a scroll and to start a new religion, and he would start telling this to people, so the first question they would ask, well, where are all these people you claim were at the event? Now, of course, he's not going to be able to account for that, because he'll be the only person reporting this to others. So he'll have to fabricate some answer to that question and say, well, they died and this and that. Well, people will ask them again, well, where's the reports of so many people dying suddenly on the George Washington Bridge? And you'll see that he'll never get off the ground. This story will never get off the ground. But if you have, and certainly the story is not going to be true in 3,000 years from then. It won't even be true 3 minutes from then. But what God wanted was that his one mankind, and that's what we discussed earlier, that there is only one design to man, and we're all identical. There's no superiority between one person and another. Everybody in the world gets treated the same way in terms of physical ailments. Person's got a lung problem, person's got a heart problem, the same procedure. People who become doctors do not study different procedures depending on the race. The human body is identical. The same way the human body is identical, so is the psyche and the mind of every human being. So in terms of what's going to bring a person happiness, it's not going to be different from between one person and the next. So having one religion is very sensible. All right, so that's just based on reason. But in terms of historically, we would not have a story today that's the unanimous history of the Jewish people, that they heard intelligent voice on a mountain coming out of fire. That would not be something that would be the unanimous history of people, of the Jewish people today, unless it really happened. Because imagine going back in time, and this person, Moses, finds a group of people and tells them, don't forget what your eyes saw on this mountain. You were there, and there were 2.5 million other people, or 600,000 men above 20, and you saw an event where fire and lightning and thunder and the mountain was quaking, and you heard intelligent voice coming out of the fire. So he tries to perpetrate this and get people to believe this. Do you think even one person would accept that instead of what they really knew happened the day before? Moses is telling them, don't forget what happened yesterday. And they knew where they were yesterday. So they would not accept it. They would look at Moses as being psychotic. And certainly this would never be something that they replaced with their true history. So it would never get off the ground. And that was the problem with Christianity. They had to force. They had to force believers and demand blind faith. But there was never any mass witnesses to the claims that they make, so there's no validity. Same thing with the Quran and Islam. So that's a core issue that really has to be accepted. And that has to be thought through. The religion, number one, has to be based on reason, just like any other part of your life, any other area of your life. You make intelligent choices, certainly when it comes to your health. So when it comes to your soul, you should be even more careful to verify what you're following in life. You live once, and you don't want to waste that life. Okay, let me just pause here and see if there's any questions or comments. And you can just type them on the screen at the bottom. I mean, there's other issues also that prevent the person from moving forward and progressing. And that would be, number one, would be peer pressure. People desire approval. They want to keep friends. And they're afraid to make decisions or make changes in their lives that is going to invite ridicule, to be ostracized. But that's something which a person really has to face. Do they want to follow the truth or not? And just to recount the other points, we talked about emotional bias, proof being required for any area of life, and also the problem with the violations of the other religions. And that's where they adopt the entire Old Testament, the Bible, the five books of Moses, but yet they conflict, and they can't answer the question on them as to why do you add to the Torah when one of God's 613 commands says not to. Okay, Chaya has a question. I'm an observant Sephardi Jew. I've been a counter-missionary and co-leader of Noachide Weekly Study Group for 3 years. I have a PhD in theology, and my master's thesis was based on rebuking the New Testament and wrong interpretation of Hebrew texts. What do you say when they finally come back and say, I don't care about the scholars, I just believe? Well, to answer that part, a person wouldn't do that when they go under the knife to get surgery. They're not going to just believe that the person's a doctor. So that they don't actually apply that in areas that are more real to them. And you go on to say, Chaya, I have not found an effective answer to that other than the fact that Hashem is closing their eyes. Judaism is of mind, Christianity is emotional. Some just will not accept truth because, ironically, they will be persecuted in the communities. Yes, that's what I just talked about, Chaya, and that is that a person has to be objective and make a decision. Do I want truth or do I want to be accepted? And if they want to really fool themselves in life and not look for intelligent and proven methods to know what God wants out of them, that of course is their prerogative. But I think if you present it to them that way and show them that in truth they don't just use belief in other areas of their life, they wouldn't just take a job believing that they're going to get paid in 12 months. All right, I address that in the book and I talk about these very specifics. So this has to be something which people are ready for emotionally. And, you know, listen, people are living a certain way for, you know, a number of decades in their life. Certainly they're going to find hurdles that are difficult to climb over. But I think with repeated discussion and, you know, applying it to themselves and being available to respond to them on a regular basis, they can slowly pull themselves out of it. So they'll sometimes need a crutch. Hopefully, you know, people will eventually generate that, you know, gain that independence of thought and emotional stability in order to make a decision, even if it goes against others. Let me know if that answers your question. Hi. Okay, I see you wrote Toda. You're welcome. Okay. Any other questions at this point? Okay, my pleasure, Chaya. I'm glad it's clear. Okay. Yeah, another thing, getting back to what I started regarding Rabbi Rishkin's statement on Orthodox Judaism, which is really not representative. Thank you, Rivka and Masi. I mean, they talk about accepting many messengers, which he didn't say it outright, but clearly he was indicating that, again, apologetics to Christianity and saying that he said that the words that Jesus was not an error. And he said a number of things there, but he was validating Christianity and Jesus. That means to say that he is invalidating all the prophets and everything in the Torah. Again, not anti-Torah, but in the future we have statements from Jeremiah and Isaiah that talk about how in the future the nations will stream to the Jews, flowing like a stream to the Jews in Jerusalem, and they'll grab on to the shirt corner of an Israelite person, a Judah, a Yehudi, which is clearly identifying the person as a Jew, and they'll say that we heard that God is with you. And they will abandon their religions, as Maimonides states, and they'll realize that they inherited fallacy from their fathers. So eventually, people will have this realization. And it's a shame that now they don't. Again, there is this trend of apologetics, which is making it even worse, and it's obscuring true Judaism from Jews and from others. So, again, the purpose of the book is to make a very clear, unapologetic presentation of what the authentic Bible, the Torah, and the prophets have stated through God. Then there's not, again, not to add to it, not to detract, not to obscure, and not to try to make friends with other religions in the name of distorting and perverting Judaism. Because then, again, like I said earlier, the response that Moses says to the Jews, when they see the Jews keeping the Torah properly, the other nations are going to be marveling at it. And they're going to say, what a wise and understanding these great people are. Okay, and Elise, you're asking, do we as Jews have responsibility to spread Judaism and evangelize? Well, that's what I'm doing right now. We're supposed to make it available and not hide it. So yes, we have to. We don't coerce, we present. And we lend our ear and our tongue. And that's it. And an intelligent person will see it. Yoni, I'm happy that your wife is doing this. This is very important work. And it has to be done, very honestly. No apologies. Stating the sources and using reason. And that's, again, another part of the book that I focused on in the beginning. And that is that if we look at God's plan, and again, I spoke about how we prove God also, in terms of that the world cannot create itself. And it needs a designer. It's impossible that we'd have such an intricate system that perfectly suited for human life. I mean, you have the multiverse theory that they have scientists today that are atheists. They want to discount God. And they came up with this theory that there's an infinite number of universes. So with an infinite number of universes, you're definitely going to come across one that happens to be perfectly suited for man, which is really ridiculous because even if you had an infinite number, that does not mean you'll have infinite variations. You could have an infinite number and you have a repetition of numerous universes that just can't house life. And if a person would use that theory, which means without God, that means just a chaotic, infinite stream of explosions going on in the universe. A new universe is being created by the second for an infinite amount of time. Well, let's understand something. You're talking about chaos, no guide, no designer. So let's look at how chaos works on Earth. And it's not my argument. I heard this recently, and I think it's a real brilliant statement, that if you look at the way smoke leaves burning wood, or if you look at an explosion, there's no design to it. Anything in terms of chaos has no design. It's completely random. And if that's what the scientists want to say, that you have a chaotic number of these explosions, and one of them by chance, and an infinite number of explosions is going to create the perfectly a universe perfectly suited for human life. Well, you don't see that that's how chaos works. So they would have to say that there is some design at a certain point. They don't. They want to avoid saying there's a God. So they're really stuck. But they feel that with an infinite number of universes, one by chance is going to definitely be perfect. And friends of mine who are writing a book on this right now have shared with me that there are multi-decimal places of exactness that you need for molecular structure and so on in order to have life. And then you can go on and ask, well, what's the possibility that you would have the produce being grown that perfectly suits the nutritive needs of animals and in humans? So you can throw that out the door, that whole multiverse theory. So you really come back to a need for a designer, and without that, you wouldn't have the perfection of the system that we see in the universe. And Dale, you're asking, do you evangelize people to become Jews and Noahides? Well, with more commandments, there's more perfection. So certainly with the, I would always suggest to the person seeking that they should accept more and to become a full-fledged 613 command following person, there's going to be much more perfection. Right, so there's one more point which is very important. And that is, again, examining once we accept God and that God designed man. Well, how did God design man? So here we come to a point of reason and the senses. Right, two faculties. Now, understand clearly that God gives you senses because he wants you to determine what you sense in contrast to what you did not sense. He doesn't want you walking off a cliff, so he gives you eyes so you can detect that. Now, if you don't trust your senses, you'll be dead very soon. So clearly he wants you to believe what you see and not to believe what you did not see. Which brings us to the claims of the other religions, which there is no witnesses for. So just from the design of the human being, itself, we see that we are to be using our senses. That's God's will. And it's so simple, but it's something which it's an argument that I don't think people hear. But if you talk to them and show them this, I think they will come around and say they do trust their senses in most areas. It's just when it comes to religion, they're really have, you know, they've swallowed the pill. They've drank the Kool-Aid, as they say, and they believe in that one area, the mind is closed and belief rules. And again, that comes from peer pressure and just from so many people of authority telling them this and seeing so many other millions and billions of others that live this way. So they really have to be, this has to be addressed head on. And reason as well is something which God gave us. Even with senses, I give an example in my book that if we see a magician make an elephant disappear off of a stage, well, we know that that's impossible. But senses alone can cause a person to be puzzled. But if they start examining what went on, they'll start realizing that that is not what took place. It never happens where the magician does not put a sheet on the elephant first, whatever he's making vanish. The sheet is always there to obscure the trap door below. Misdirection, the mirror, the smoke. There's always something which is necessary before it vanishes. And if a person recognizes that, they'll realize that there must be a need for that. So again, reason and senses will bring a person to a certain realization. And since God wants you to use your reason and senses, he wants you to not believe anything which did not take place. And that's in the present and in the past. And without any type of masses of witnesses, we cannot say that an event, a claim, took place. And no other person should either. It's just that the appeal of the other religions is what brings a lot of people to ignore their minds. Okay, so that's an unfortunate state of affairs, but I'm just trying to point out that there are observations that we could make. We could use reason and show people that they do use this in other areas in life, so it can help them. Getting back to Yoni and Chaya in terms of evangelizing and Chaya and teaching people, yes, we can't keep it to ourselves. We're not supposed to. We're supposed to uphold it and make it available. And there can't be any type of mitigating our words or diluting our words. And Chaya, you're asking, how do you particularly explain the difference between knowledge and faith? You said you have a difficulty explaining this. Knowledge, again, is based on the senses and the reason, those faculties. We have knowledge of what we witness with our senses, what we hear with our ears, see with our eyes. But then again, like the example of the magician, we have to use our intelligence, our reason, to figure out what we have questions on in terms of the senses. And this was the reason why God orchestrated Sinai in a manner with fire. Because that fire is the only element that a biological organism cannot survive in. Any other element, any other degree of temperature, you have organisms that are alive. In the ice, in the heat, in the desert, in sand, in wind, any organism can survive. In water, the one element that no organism can exist in is fire. Now you understand why God created Sinai with a mountain ablaze and creating a voice, an intelligent voice, coming out of that fire. Because this is the one proof that that intelligence is not biological, meaning it's not of earth. Now they knew there was something which is unaffected by fire, which was spontaneous, and they knew it was intelligent, and therefore this is the proof that it was not anything from earth that was giving them the law, giving them the Bible. Faith, on the other hand, there is a good type of faith, but there's another type of faith, which is what religious faith is. Religious faith is where you're believing in facts that didn't take place. But if you have a good friend, well, let's use God, because that's what we're talking about, religion. If God, throughout history, had stepped in to help out righteous people, and we see this throughout, Adam and Cain and Abraham and Noah and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and the 12 tribes. And throughout time, people that were righteous earned protection, even miracles. So that builds a faith and a certain pattern of how God operates. So we do have faith, but that's after we have seen exactly how he operates. Again, it's not a blind faith. It's something which is based on fact. But the wrong type of faith is where it's not based on fact. And yes, Christianity is based on fear. They have all these stories going to hell. They fabricate all this in order to get followers. It just shows you how insecure the other religions are, that they need to coerce people to follow it. A person who knows the truth, like Einstein, never forced people by the sword to accept his mathematics. Newton, Socrates, Plato, individuals who are attached to truth, they share it, and there's no coercion because they are so convinced how accepting people will be of something which is clear. 2 + 2 = 4. I don't have to force you about that. All right, hi, good. I'm glad it's clear. Okay. And the other religions, I mean, they bring in Trinity and polytheism. They start developing ideas that are just completely unintelligible. But again, when there's faith involved, the mind is absent. And with the promise of being forgiven for your sins, I mean, that's why it took on like wild, it spread like wildfire. And I touch in the book as well on Christianity wants to, they claim that Jesus is the fulfillment of Isaiah. So there's two major problems with that. Number one, Isaiah is talking about something which happened in the past. And I believe that's the chronology. But what Christianity does is it takes that story and uses it, and it says, because the nations of the world were saying that the man was punished. But man in the Torah many times means an entire people. Christianity, who doesn't have, they don't have the, they're not the authorities on the Bible. The Jews are. They're the ones that received it. They explain that, no, there's many times that God will use the term man. The Hebrew word is ish. And that could mean a collection of people. But they want to say, no, because the people back then were saying about the Jews that they, why are they downtrodden? Why are they getting punished? What do they do wrong? They must be dying because, they must be getting punished because of our sins. So that's what the people actually said. It's recorded in Isaiah 53. So Christianity latched onto that, and they made this very attracting story of Jesus being victimized, and they said, this is him. This is the man that we're talking about. So they took a story which talks about a group of people, termed in Hebrew as Ish, and in the book I give, I think, at least 4 different areas in the Torah where Ish, or man, refers to a group of people, the entire nation, not just one person. But they distort it, of course, because they have an agenda to promote Jesus. And then on top of that, they come up with this Trinity, and then they fabricate other parts of the Torah. Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver by 12 brothers. And Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver by his 12 disciples. And Moses was told by God, and actually this week's Parsha, go down to Egypt because all the men that sought your life have died. And then they copy that, and Jesus is told to go down to Israel or somewhere because all the people that sought your life are dead. Clear, plagiarisms. And again, the problem with the Trinity is that it's just incomprehensible. You could take a piece of paper, any physical object, you could divide it into 3. But you can't take an idea of something which is not physical and cut it into parts. God also is not physical. So you can't say this parts to God. And then on top of that, to say that God made himself a frail human being subject to death, that makes no sense. But this story is aimed to get people feel sympathy for victimized Jesus. And it worked. But if you're not looking for truth, you know, a lot of things can be believed. Okay. All right, so that's, I think that covers a lot of the main, there's a lot, but I want to just give a presentation that is, you know, again, touching on the 3 parts. And I really want to focus on showing the brilliance of the Bible, of the Torah. So we touched on the emotional biases, the crippled mind of an individual, a lot of things that are holding a person back, preventing them from actually accepting truth, fear of being ostracized. But at the same time, we've shown that there's no purpose for new religions. It shows ignorance on God's part that he didn't know what would happen in the future, so now he has to, got to change the law, got to bring in a new religion. I mean, very foolish suggestions. And I think the example that we gave is very salient, and that's that just as food never changed because the human biology never changed, so God knew what man would need, and he never had to change food throughout time, so the need for man's religious life doesn't have to change. He knew the future, he knew that man is not changing psychologically or mentally, intelligently, and therefore one religion that should never change. That's why it makes sense in this Torah. He says, don't add and don't subtract. Because man is not changing. So there's no need to alter the Torah at all. Let me see if there's any questions. I'll pause here. Any comments or questions? And what I'll do next is give a few examples from the Torah just to show you how the other religions are just skin deep. There's nothing beyond the words. Read the Quran, read the Bible, the New Testament, I mean, and that's it. That's the word. There's no commentary. There's no detection of anything more than just the written word, like a novel. But you look at the world, and there's tremendous wisdom that unfolds in every part of the physical universe. And scientists are still trying to figure out so much. The greatest minds say we're just scratching the surface. Because they see that there's immense wisdom in the Creator to make such a universe. But he was kind enough to share hints in the various elements that he created that expose wisdom and systems that operate in harmony. And Chaya, you're asking, how would you offer support to those of us who are constantly asked to attend church and Christian functions from people who are genuinely friends and family? Explain to them that you're happy to converse with them, but invite them to your home. You can't support idolatry, deification of man, a religion that violates God by adding on to it. You're following God, and God said this clearly, and they have that. They have the Old Testament, so let them look at it themselves. But don't cut them off. Again, show them that you really would like to share, but invite them to your home. Or invite them to a shul or a temple. Right? So this way you're not showing any type of disconcern, but that you're trying, as a matter of fact, to do what they want, and that's to follow God. And I think if you present it that way, they'll respect and admire that you're being honest and you really want to keep to what God said. So it won't be a rejection of God, it'll be a fulfillment, and I think they'll have to agree to that. So that, I think, would be a good approach. Good, so you have the answer. Is it working out, Chaya? Are you finding that your Christian friends, your Gentile friends, are hearing ideas? Are there any questions that they're bringing up that are difficult? Okay, so keep working with them. Get the real questions out. See what their core issues are. And I think if they read my book, they will get a lot of answers. Again, I didn't sidestep anything. I didn't mince words. Actually, a close friend said to me today he feels that it's a little aggressive. I'll have to find out from him what he means. But I don't think you could state the truth and dilute it. If he's referring to the cover of the Bible, God's Only Religion, yeah, it's not politically correct. But you can't be politically correct. You really have to say that there is no other religion. And explain it. I mean, that's what God said. And you're right, they've left us much more satisfied with the relationship with Hashem. The best we can do. Nachon, right? Good. Keep up the good work, Chaya. Okay, so let me move on to, let me see the end of the questions. Now, I want to take up something which was a recent discovery, again in the Torah. And this is something which is so basic. It was like It was such an eye-opener, but I never really sat down. I mean, you know, there's so much to learn. So I'm talking about kosher laws. So if I asked you, what is kosher about, what would you say? I'll let you folks do a little bit of the talking now. What is your understanding of kosher? Succinctly. And again, if there's any of you that feel you have friends that might enjoy the conversation, there's a blue link at the bottom of the screen. It says share on Facebook. It'll put a post onto your Facebook page and it'll invite friends to join. So feel free. It should not close the chat. So you tell me, what is your idea of kosher? All right, Dale, you're writing what is proper. Aliza, you're writing a very basic way that we can keep ourselves holy. All right, too general. Give me specifics. And again, this is just one example of how God's Torah is just like God's universe, that there is such an amazing amount of precision and underlying wisdom that's below the surface, but the clues are right there in the psukim, in the Torah verses, in the Bible's verses. God designed it in the way that the clues are there, and if a person has studied it under an intelligent Orthodox rabbi for a while, he'll start being able to unravel these clues himself. And Michael is writing the standard by which you consume food according to the Bible. Okay. Now I'll start off with a question. Why is it that there's no restriction on any fruit or vegetable? No vegetation has any restriction. And minerals that are not food, there's no prohibition to take sand and put it in your mouth and swallow it. You wouldn't make a blessing on it. It's not food. So minerals, which are not food, again, nothing whatsoever. There's no kosher does not apply to minerals. Kosher does not apply to fruits or vegetables, any vegetation. What's the one area that kosher applies to? And Nissim in San Diego, good to see you. Amongst the reasons, keeping us separate from celebrations, behaviors which erode our kedusha, our holiness. Okay? But isn't it interesting? You ever think about that? Kosher does not apply to foods and vegetables, to fruits and vegetables. No blood? Well, blood is not an idea of kosher, because blood is not a food, Dale. Blood is a restriction. If you read Maimonides' Guide for Perplex, is that there was a ancient custom that peoples would kill an animal, collect the blood, and they would dine on the animal's flesh while they believed that demons would be dining on the blood. And they thought that through that union of them eating together with these imaginary demons, that camaraderie would be built between the two of them, and they would gain some sort of protection from these demons. So the prohibition comes from an ancient idolatrous right. And that's why we spill the blood on the ground and on the altar, and we cover it when we slaughter an animal, we cover the blood. But it has nothing to do with the laws of kosher. And you'll see that the blood is not mentioned there. It's only animals. And Rivka, you're writing, it's basically animal products that have restrictions, correct? All right. Does it have anything to do with neshama, with the soul? But the first point is that it's just the animal kingdom. All right, so that's the first thing I want to show you. Now, here's the idea, and I'll just make some inroads. And it's not difficult. It's just a matter of examining God's words in the Torah, in the Bible, and listening to them, and seeing how they're categorized. Now, you'll notice that the terms are different when it comes to animals that are not kosher. For example, the pig, the horse, any hooved animals that don't chew their cud. So it says that tame, impure. When you get to things that crawl on the ground, the Torah isolates things, another category, things that crawl on the ground. Snakes, spiders, rodents. There it doesn't say the word tame, it says sheketz. Sheketz means that abhorrent. It should be something that you revile. Very interesting. Two different categories. You can't eat any of those species. But God said there's something else that has to be told to you over here, that this category is over here. And at the very end, after it goes through the fish and the birds and the animals, then at the very end, it starts off with beasts, with mammals that you can't have. Then it goes on to, it goes fish, it goes into birds, insects. But then it goes back to the beasts at the very end, and then it talks about animals that have paws. Very interesting, another category. And J.M. is saying animals feel pain. It's a life being given for our existence. Okay, I'm not sure what you're getting at. I mean, we can eat some animals, so, and we can eat others. The question is, why is that distinction only in animals and not in vegetation or minerals? I mean, water anywhere you can have. Any fruit, any vegetable, any spice. It's only in the animal kingdom that this law of kosher comes in. What's the difference between animals and everything else? Okay, Jim, here's the question. So again, what you have to do is you have to study the Torah, what God wrote, and you start to see these different categories. And then you have different terms. Mammals that are not kosher, all right, the tummy, impure. But things that crawl on the ground, it's not called tummy, it's called sheketz. Something that you have to revile. And then we wonder why a third category at the end of mammals that have paws. Well, why didn't God just group the lions and dogs and cats in the first category of animals when he talked about split hooves and chewing cud? So here's an amazing thing. If you look at the signs that God gave us in the Torah, what indicates kosher and non-kosher species, where do you find the signs? So you find in the mammals hooves, right, on the feet. You find in the fish its fins and scales. You find with the insects a number of legs, or if it creeps. And interesting thing enough, in the pawed animals, again, the indication have to do with the hands. What is common about the location of all of those signs? Right, Rivka, very good. Do we have stories about eating giraffes? I don't know of any stories. I've heard that they just, the neck is so long, they don't know where, because it is kosher. They just don't know where to do the slaughtering, what part of the neck. I'm not sure if that's accurate. Not a strange question at all, Chaya. Don't worry about it. Okay, JM, you just hit the nail on the head. Exactly. All the signs, and even the birds, it doesn't say the signs in the Torah, but the rabbis talk in the Talmud, and they say that the signs of the birds are in their claws. Again, as Jim just said, it has to do with their mobility. Now, why would that be? Why would the signs for kosher have to do with an animal's locomotion, its ability to transport itself, to move? What is it about mobility? Jim, take it to the next step. What is it about mobility or locomotion that you think is the reason that the signs for kosher laws are in the area of mobility of the animal? So this is where we see a slow progression of examining the facts, going step by step until we finally arrive at the answer. I'll give you a minute. I'd like you to think about this. Fins and scales, that's how a fish moves. The feet of an animal, the hooves, that's how mammals move. The birds, their feet, that's how they move. You could say there's wings also, but the feet as well as gives it mobility. Okay, that's a health issue, Jim, that you're mentioning. That the bottom feeders. And then the snakes and the insects and the rodents, they all are on the ground. And there, it's not enough that they're just impure, but that God calls it sheketz. You have to revile those things. So here's something very interesting. And that is that this is where we set apart animals from all other things. By the fact that something is mobile, that's true, Chaya. There are certain locusts you can have. but I just have to stick to being a general principle. Now, okay, I'm going to explain, Jim. Right, so scales versus skin on fish versus sharks, etc. Okay, well, fins and scales are the signs for kosher fish. I'm not going to get into the specifics, because you also have sharks that have fins, but they have no scales. So why both? That I can't answer. But I just wanted to draw a parallel with all the signs of animals and a distinction between animals and everything else that has no kosher laws whatsoever. I believe the idea is identification. The person does not identify with a mountain. He doesn't take a rock home to become its pet. All right, he doesn't talk to a plant. However, when it comes to animals, there's identification. Why is there identification? Because they're alive. And that's exhibited by its mobility. It has the ability to move itself towards something it wants, away from something it fears. It has the ability. Even some would say that there's a sense of play in certain animals, or they do that in their youth to exercise the muscles. But now what comes with identification is a problem for man. See, if man identifies with things that are disgusting and he eats them, meaning the identification is through eating them, now what happens is he breaks down a very important barrier that God wants us to have. And as a Jew, because Noahide does not have the law of kosher, so as a Jew, God gave us the obligation to learn the Torah and to teach it. But in order to learn and to teach, we have to be in control of our emotions so our mind can be free and not be chasing after desires. Because you can't have both. A person can't be satisfying all of his lusts. And then he's also going to be the same person that could sit down and open the Talmud or the Torah or the Bible and study for hours. Because the person will be too emotionally driven in order to have the patience that he needs to use the mind. And the truth is, going after desires all the time does not allow the person the time to use his mind and to explore God's wisdom. So God wants the Jew, and of course he'd like other people as well to follow the Torah, but the Jew is the only monotheist at the time, and he gave the law to Abraham, who was monotheistic, and everybody else was idolatrous at the time. So he was the most suitable emissary to the world to have the Torah, so he gave it to his descendants. So every human being would benefit by kosher, but it's just presently it's the Jews' law. Now, since a person will identify with certain animals, it will cause his emotions to be agitated, and emotions spill over into other areas. It talks about when the Jews committed the sin of the gold calf, that they got up and they got involved in sexual intercourse as well. Meaning once their idolatrous emotion was unrestrained, their other emotions, it spilled over into other emotions too. So in order to have the person in control of his emotions, so it works that we have to have, in terms of being able to study, well, that's the objective, is to study God. So we have to have a control on emotions that would spill over into other areas and have restraint. So when we study, we also have a control. So the sexual laws and the laws of kosher are the two main drives in man. You know, the appetitive drive and the sexual drive. And psychologists have said this, and the rabbis are in full agreement. So by having controls in those areas, it now makes the person more sedate, more under control, and his mind is now more free to study. But if a person is eating animals with which he identifies, he now breaks down the barrier of his appetitive drive, meaning he becomes impure. That's tameh. If he eats any mammal that he wants, he eats any fish that he wants. And it's because he identifies with them that it creates this type of a problem. Now, in terms of the insects and things that crawl on the ground, there it said that they should be reviling to you, not just that they're impure. And here's another idea. See, things close to the ground, as Rabbi Chait once said, it reminds a person of death, of what's under the ground. So things that are on the ground, the person naturally has more of a disgust for than animals mammals or fish. Things that crawl, that are close to the ground, mice, rodents, insects, snakes, there's a natural repulsion to these species. That's because it reminds a person of death. And God doesn't want that. God said in Ecclesiastes, in Kohelet, that he planted the world in man's heart, meaning he gave man a feeling of a certain amount of eternity. Man has to feel that he's going to be here for a while. Person thinks that he's going to die tomorrow, he just can't function. He can't be morbid. So therefore, God does not want that identification with those animals. But again, the identification is because it moves, and you identify with it as another living being. Therefore, there's no restriction on vegetation. Any fruit, any vegetable is fine. There's no laws because you don't identify with them through eating. So you see, very important ideas here. One is that the kosher inheres only in the animal world because those things move, and that's indicated by the signs being in the organs of locomotion, the fins and scales, the legs, the hooves, right? The legs of insects, the fact that it crawls through on its belly by a snake. So you see, that's what God is showing you. He's giving you a hint in the Torah as to why kosher exists. One is to make sure you're not just free to eat everything all the time. So there's certain animals, certain mammals, certain fish. Again, and it's the locomotion. It's the part that propels it that causes us to identify with it. Because things that don't move, that are static, that are inanimate, we don't identify with bark on the tree or a flower. We don't look at it as something which is precious. It's something that we take home and that we pet. We don't have that identification. So there's no restriction. There's no fear that there'll be any identification with vegetation. But there is with animals. So one law is that we have a limitation on food. So this way we're not eating anything. We're not completely unrestrained in our primary instinct of the appetite of eating. Another is the creeping things on the ground. Those we have to look at not only as impure, but that we have to abhor them. They have to be reviled. Because God wants a greater distance with things that have to do with the ground, with death. He doesn't want a person thinking about death. He wants a person thinking about life. Okay? And what I'll take up next then is about the paws, the animals that are pawed, and why that was not included in the first section of mammals. Why did God save that to the end and talked about things with paws? Well, let me just pause for a minute and see the questions you have. Okay. Animals, Rivka's writing, animals may not be kosher due to blood, chewing its cud, fish needs fins, scales, right? A lot more fruit and vegetation basically are kosher if they are washed properly. You don't have to wash them, Rivka. That does not make them kosher. Hi, are you writing? Do we have any stories about eating giraffes? Okay, we took that up already. All right. Lobsters, locusts, that's correct, Chaya. I mentioned that before, but again, I'm just giving the broad strokes. Okay. And I'm not sure, Chaya, of your last statement. Ima Shalom. All right. Okay, now let's take up the last part that God addresses in the kosher laws, and that is about an animal that has paws. So there, that was not included in the first account where he talked about split hooves. And again, I can't answer the chewing of the cud. I don't have an answer to that. But I just want to, again, I want to just address what I feel is a commonality between all these signs in general. Dale, you're asking, I don't understand about death. Doesn't eating a dead cow remind one of death? No. When it's on your plate, it's food. You're not looking at it as a dead cow at that point. And it's not eating something that's dead. It's something which is on the ground that you identify with the earth. The surface of the earth is a bothersome thing. Okay? All right, and as far as I know, there is nothing kosher which is a creeping thing on the earth. Now, what's the idea with the paws? And here's a very interesting thing as well. What type of animals do we take as pets? Exactly. We take pawed animals. Why? Why is that? See, here, there's greater identification. An animal with paws more closely offers us identification. It looks like the hands that we use are such an important organ that we have, the limb, that we can't do anything without hands. Writing, communication, our work. And we see something else that has paws that resemble the hands. This offers greater identification. I believe here, these animals are off limits for a different reason. And that's the opposite of what we had before. not that you should revile, but that animals with paws that you don't kill and eat, it engenders more mercy to animals and to other people. Because now you're not eating, you're not treating as food something which has a closer resemblance to yourself. So you don't kill them. It's an act of mercy. And it's something which, again, it engenders a feeling of mercy. That's why we throw away the mother bird before we take the eggs. Another one in the 6th century 13 commands. But here you see it expressed in another way, where they're off limits. Don't take these animals as food. And I believe that's why it's not included in the general category of mammals that God talks about at the beginning. But it's a separate category treated at the end, because it is now it's not a matter of breaking the identification. It's the opposite. It's causing identification. So some animals you don't eat because you want to break identification with things that are disgusting, or you want to have a limitation on certain species so you control your appetitive drive. But at the same time, you can have a refraining from eating animals, and that helps. That's a positive. That's something which causes a positive emotion to be engendered inside of ourselves. So you see how God set it up that it's a separate category. It's not included in the animals that are called the mammals in the beginning, because these are not eaten for a separate reason. Yeah, Jim, exactly. All right, there's an identification. There's a similarity. Okay. All right. So let me. That's what I wanted to say on kosher. I hope this is enlightening. Now we have a deeper appreciation of what is kosher about. But it's right there in the verses. It's right there in the Torah. It's just a matter of taking the time to look through it and start to see how God set up that entire section, what section follows next, why he separated the pawed animals until the end when they could have been included with mammals in the beginning. No, it's a separate consideration. And the different words, whether it's tameh, impure, whether it's sheketz, something they have to revile. But the main concept here is that you see it's in the locomotion, something which moves, and that's in the fins, the scales, the part of the animal that gives it mobility. Because that's what man identifies with. Oh, that thing moves too, just like me. So on a very basic level, man identifies with these things. That's why people take pets, and that's why there's even laws. You can kill an insect, you can't kill a dog. Animal cruelty, whoever said that there's a difference between the two? People said that because the way we view them, because of our psyches, because of identification. People even mourn when they have a pet for 10, 15 years and it dies. And rightfully so. The identification is real. Yes, Nism, the restrictions for different reasons based on what God wrote would indicate tempering of different aspects of our psychology. Yes. Okay, let me pause here, see if there's any questions or comments. And again, if you didn't hear the entire class, it's being recorded, so I'll make sure that it's placed on the Bible book page on the website, so you can come back to it and listen to the entire class. All right, catfish, no fins and scales, unless you're making a joke there. All right, Jim, I hope that there are, I'm calling you Jim, but it says JM on screen. Yes, I mean, you spent time learning. This is what God gave us as being the most interesting pursuit and the most enlightening, and the person gets the most enjoyment when he learns and he uncovers the clues that God put in the Torah, and then you start seeing a whole world of ideas, and it's amazing. So I hope that you learn more, you continue learning. Any fish that has fins and scales would be kosher, Yoni. I mean, we'll have to open up the Shulchan Aruch and see. I mean, Rashi mentions that as long as the scales are on the fish while it's in the water, because some fish, they lose the scales when you take them out of the water. So there's more to it than just this. I mean, you have the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, based on 300 years of the rabbis discussing the oral law and the Talmud that was written down after a 300-year period. So there's a tremendous amount. Here we're going through the basic philosophy and understanding the clues. And this is just a first step. And Chaya, you're writing, okay, and the time frame between dairy and meat is different than meat and dairy. I have been taught this. I don't know what life and death has to do. No, it's just that meat is something, there's a machlokas, there's an argument in the amongst the rabbis as to what the reason why we wait after having meat. Is it because that the digestion process of meat takes about 6 hours, So a person is still burping up and he has a flavor of meat in his mouth for about 6 hours. So you shouldn't have milk during that time. That's a rabbinic law. Right? The Torah law is just not to eat them together, cook them together, and to benefit from the mixture. But the rabbinic law, you have they added on a time. Now, I believe even cheese, there are certain types of hard cheeses that if they had the same effect, you'd have to wait 6 hours after the cheeses too. So that's one view. The other view is that meat stays in your teeth for about 6 hours. So the rabbis didn't want you having that flavor and then having milk immediately afterwards. But if a person has milk and he washes his mouth out and has it a cracker, that completely cleanses his palate, and then he can have meat right afterwards because there's no residue. And Jam, you're writing, I was told growing up that if you can choose what you put in your mouth, you should be able to choose what comes out of it. Simple explanation of kosher. Okay. I'm not sure of the idea. Oh, I see what you're saying. That if you choose what you put in your mouth, meaning you have control over your appetite, your appetitive drive, then you can choose what you speak about, meaning you can controlling your thoughts. Very good. I like that. Okay. Any other questions or comments? I'll pause over here. But I hope this gives you a whole new appreciation for Torah, for specifically kosher, but to see how the words are organized is really a whole system of clues that God wrote with such many levels of wisdom. And there's so much more. Okay, right, Jim. Okay. All right, Jay in Florida, you're writing, this might be off topic, but you mentioned several times that God knows the future. How have we come to understand this to be the case? In what ways does the Torah allude to this being in God's nature? Or have we just assumed this idea over time? Doesn't this idea conflict with free will? Yes, that's a famous question Maimonides quotes in his Mishnah Torah. The answer is that God's knowledge is not like our knowledge. It's not like cause and effect. Meaning, if you could tell me that you know exactly my psychological nature and all the different variables that will come into play in my day tomorrow, and you've computerized them, and you can compute exactly what I'm going to do, so now you're basing your knowledge on cause and effect. And it would have to be accurate. And I wouldn't be able to do otherwise, because you're basing your knowledge on cause and effect. Just like if you set up a bunch of dominoes, you know what the future will be based on the distance of the dominoes, the weight of the dominoes, the speed. You'll be able to calculate exactly. If you knew all the variables, you'd know exactly what's going to happen, you know, 60 seconds down the line once you hit that first domino. But that's based on laws of cause and effect. God's knowledge, as Maimonides says, is not law, is not through cause and effect. So there is no, you can look at it like a weather, you know, a meteorologist. He tells you the weather tomorrow, but he's not causing it. Now, of course, he's using cause and effect. But just as an analogy, knowledge does not mean my free will is gone. And the truth is, you know it yourself. That you know that you're free to choose, even with God's knowledge. And the reason why we know, the first part of your question, how do we know God knows the future, is you see the statements in the Torah, where he says by the Tower of Babel that they will not leave off building the tower if they're left to do what they're doing. He's telling you the future. He's telling you through the prophets what's going to transpire. People would be wiped out if they disobey, and you see that they were. And the Jews didn't follow God, they followed idolatry. The most tragic events took place, and that's exactly what they did in the first temple. They worshipped idolatry, and there was a great slaughter. Right, so you have numerous cases. And God told Moses that he knows that Pharaoh is not going to listen. Of course, the last five plagues, God hardened his heart. It's a separate case. There were four instances in history where God did not allow a person to repent from their ways in order that they should die in the sins, Maimonides says, that they did from their own free will at first. So God didn't cause Pharaoh to harm himself. He harmed himself to such a degree that Maimonides says the punishment of certain rare individuals is that their ability to repent is removed in order that they die in the sins that they did with their own free will at the outset. So again, in terms of your own senses, you know, Jay, that you have free will. Nothing is coercing you. So you know that to be real, just from your own experience right now, You could lift off that pen on the table or whatever you have on the table, or you could not do it. Free will. Rivka and Muncie, you're asking, according to the rabbis, can you rinse from meat and not wait? No, because meat does have a definite effect that you can't eradicate without the time span afterwards. Right? It's too solid. It's dense. It sticks in the teeth. So even if you do all that, the rabbis made a law. We have to follow that. But those properties don't exist in liquid, in milk. The question would come up if you had like a meat soup. What would be the case? What would be the law in that case? But I don't think that we distinguish anymore or have ever distinguished between liquid meat or solid meat. All right, Jane, my pleasure. I hope if it's not clear, ask again. All right, it's important that the points are clear. Okay. Does everybody have time for one more Torah example or any questions? There's one more example I'd like to do, which also is just amazing. And I just want to leave you with, a wow. I want you to have the same feeling I had when I went through these areas. And again, if you want, I'll wait. I mean, you can invite other friends to join for the next part, which is not related to anything we did yet. There's the share link on Facebook. You can use your email and send the link. We could start in a few minutes. If you want to take a break, I know we're going for an hour and a half here. I just put the link online, so you can share that link. Wait a few minutes if you want to share that by email. And also, if you're on Facebook, there's a blue link at the bottom of the screen. You just click on that, and that'll post it to your page, and you can invite friends. You can add a little note. Okay, and for what we're going to do next, just copy and paste that second link into a new browser window. I'd like you to have this visual as we do this next and last portion of the presentation. So you can just copy and paste that link, that second link I just put, and open it up in a new browser window so you have the image. And we'll resume it in 2 minutes, okay? Okay. All right, so one other portion. I'm going to refer more to the design, just not verbatim, but based on the image that you see, the menorah. So the menorah was one of the vessels in the temple, and probably one of the most intricately designed. We have to understand, what is it all about? It's not just something beautiful. Everything that God created has to have great ideas to it. Now, in the temple, we primarily learn ideas from all of the vessels. And there's different views from the rabbis as to what the temple is. When Moses created it, Sforno explains that he first put up the curtains, either it was miraculously, or he suspended the curtains that were on the outside of the temple, and then he built the walls underneath. A very odd type of method of creation. Normally you build the structure and then you build the covering. Now the reason for this is because the temple is not a building. The temple is a covering. And that's why it's the Mishkan. It's called Mishkan. And the Mishkan, the rabbis say, refers to the covering, not to the structure. It refers to the curtains. That means the curtains have a primary feature. Now, what do curtains do? Curtains, what's the function of a curtain? You tell me. Right? Nissim, you're writing separation, good. And JM, again, you hit the nail on the head. Cover, hide, protect. Okay, it's a cover, which is a separation of sorts, but primarily a cover. So why is it that the temple is a cover? And you know that Sforno, and I believe others, state that the temple, the Mishkan, was only created, it was only given as a law, as a response to the golden calf. What do they mean? It means that, what was the sin of the golden calf? I'll ask you another question. What was the sin of the golden calf? Impatience, right? That's what prodded the sin, but what was the sin itself? See, what were the words? Again, go back to the verses. And again, it was a very small minority of the Jews that sinned. There were about 2.5 million Jews, only 3,000 people. And they attribute that to the mixed multitude that exited with the Jews from Egypt, the Egyptians. Okay, Nissen, good. Physical intermediary. And Rivka, right? Need for a physical leader. And Yoni, writing idolatry. Right, so what were the words that the Jews said? They said to Aaron that the man Moses who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. They started counting the 40 days that Moses said that he would come down. They started counting too early. So when their count was up, Moses was not supposed to be there yet. Moses came down on time. But since they counted too early, the 40 days expired and Moses wasn't there. But they said, Moses, the man who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. Of course he's a man. Why is the word man put into the Torah? See, the reason is that God is highlighting what their sin was. And like Rivka said, need for a physical leader. They couldn't deal with not having some sort of a physical leader. So they created their own expression of religion. And this is what their sin was. Idolatry is when man invents strange gods. That's why in Hebrew it's called Avodah Zorah. Avodah means worship. Zorah means strange. Strange means different than what God commanded you. That's why God could command you to put two golden cherubs on top of the ark. That's not idolatry because that came from God's words. It's when man invents new forms of worship that he sins. So that's what the Jews did regarding the golden calf. They invented a new form of worship. Now, Ramban, Nachmanides, states that no fool would say that the gold earrings that they had, that they melted into the calf, is what took them out of Egypt. They thought that there was some force that they can relate to through this calf. So they weren't saying that this was God, but it still was a human creation. It's not something which God created. So now what does it mean that Sforno and the other rabbis say that the temple, the Mishkan, is a response to the golden calf? It's God's way of giving a concession to man. It was not part of the original plan, but now that man demonstrated the need for some sort of physicality in his worship of God, God said this is how it's going to go. It's going to be a very highly detailed structure with tremendous amount of laws, in terms of how the sacrifices are, how do you carry the animals when you slaughter them? What corners of the altar do you put the blood on for different sacrifices? What times of the day do you light the candelabrum, the menorah, and so on? Tremendous amount of details. But the intent was to show the Jews that you can't have your own free expression, similar to what Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, did when they had a strange fire. They wanted to serve God in their own way, and they were killed. So how does God address that? He tells you that there's areas of knowledge that you can't know. Things are outside of human comprehension or the human ability to create. This now answers our first question as to why the covers are primary. Because it's showing you that there is something covered from our intellect. So that's why Moses put the covers on first, because this was really a structure that its primary concept is to teach man that there's areas that are off limits to man's mind. There's things you can know and there's things you can't. So the covering teaches the first lesson, which is a response to the golden calf, which was man's free thinking and his own conviction that he can come up with a religious expression of his own imagination. No, you can't. There's things that are covered. So the temple primarily was a covering to show that there are things off limits. Now, the temple itself had two rooms. There was a room which had the menorah and the gold altar for incense and the table for the showbread. But then there was a room that was off limits that had the ark inside of it that you could never enter. And that's where Aaron's sons went in. And if you go into that room, only the Kohen, the high priest, could only go in twice on Yom Kippur. He goes in to bring incense, He leaves, and he comes in later to remove the fire pan after the incense is burnt. But even when he goes in, what is the whole reason why he brings incense into the Holy of Holies, where the Ark is? Again, the cloud that the incense made, and that's what it says in the verses, is to make a covering again. Meaning there is a wall between us and our knowledge of God. We have to know that. That's what God said to the most perfected man, Moses. Moses said, God, show me your honor, meaning show me your true essence. And God said to Moses, man can't know me while he's alive. That was God's response. So even when the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, does go into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, for a separate reason, he has to cloud up that room, so even he has a veil between him and God. And he can't understand God. We have to know that at all times. But the structure of the temple is two rooms. A room that you can go into daily. The priest did go in there daily. And a room that you cannot go into. So not only is the covering teaching that there's a wall between us and our knowledge of God, but even in the temple itself, there's a room that you can't go into. However, if there's a room that you can go into, this means that these areas we can know about God. Right? Ipso facto. The room we can't go in means areas of God and what he really is off limits. And that's why there are angels. We don't know what angels are either. So angels are on top of the ark to show this idea. So that's why the angels themselves, they weren't made out of pieces and assembled. They were a solid block and they had to be hammered out into two angels and the ark covered. The menorah also, but the menorah could not be assembled. It had to be hammered out of one block of gold. Imagine what a job that was. And it even says in the Torah that the rabbis say that Moses was perplexed as to the design of the menorah. But once again, the menorah, the altar for incense, and the table that had the showbread, those were the only three elements in the room called the holies, and that the priests went into daily. They lit the menorah daily. They had the showbread on there from Friday to Friday, and they had the incense. So we have to understand what these three things are, meaning the three areas of knowledge. The menorah has a very intricate design. We have six branches coming out of a seventh. So I'll ask you a few questions. Why couldn't you have six branches all perfectly vertical? Why did, just like the center stem is perfectly vertical and it rests on the ground. Why did the six branches have to come out from the seventh? Number two, what's the idea of the designs on the menorah? There were three designs on menorah. Now what you had were, you had a sphere, you had a flower, and you had a goblet, a cup. We have to understand what these three things are. And these are all identical on the six. The seventh branch in the middle has a few more. Again, you have a sphere. What does that represent? Flowers. What does that represent? And a cup. Very strange. And the majority of objects, if you look at the image, you can see which is counted the most. You have most instances on the menorah of the cup. You can see that underneath the basins on the top, right below it, there's a sphere, but then three cups. So right away you've got 21, and then you get a 22nd cup at the bottom, right near the base. So why is it that the cups are the majority of the designs? And this you can only answer once you know what the cup is. And again, I want to stress that the menorah was made out of a hammered piece, a hammered large chunk of gold, not assembled with parts. Just like the cherubs on top of the ark. Now, that concept of solid, pure gold indicates something most precious. And what is most precious, the Torah talks about as gold, it equates it to knowledge. Not only that, but the menorah is lit with light. And the Torah also talks about light as knowledge. It says, Ner mitzvah v'torah or. One flame is a mitzvah. But Torah is a whole light. That's trying to tell you that one mitzvah is a good, it gives you some illumination, but you don't call it light. Only when you have the entire Torah being followed, do you say it now that you have really imbued yourself with wisdom. So we see that just like the angels dealing with something metaphysical, something above the physical, so knowledge is also metaphysical. Knowledge is not something you can cut in half. It's not something which has location. So the first step is that Noah is dealing with knowledge. So now, what's the knowledge that the Torah is giving us that the in the design of the menorah? Well, if we look at the branches, we have six coming out of the seventh. What does that correlate to? You tell me, what does that correlate to? Six branches emanating from a seventh. Okay, Yoni, good. Shabbos. Meaning, the 6 days of creation and the seventh, which is the Sabbath. Now we can start to see something very interesting. I asked you earlier why the six other branches don't stand on the ground like the seventh in the middle. Jim, very good. The six cannot exist or function without the seventh. Meaning that the 6 days of creation emanate from the God who rested on the seventh. That was what we call dependent existence. The universe didn't have to exist. It only exists as a dependent way. So that means they're suspended on the seventh. They're resting. We're not saying the middle branch is God. Of course not. But we're saying that the seventh correlates to creation, to the God who rested after creation. It means to tell you that the physical world is dependent upon God. A very primary concept. So now we understand that in the temple, the most primary lesson we need to know is who is this God we're relating to in temple. And just as we say in the morning, the first prayers of the morning are Baruch She'amar V'Hoya Olam. Blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into existence. Our definition of God is the cause of the universe, the creator. So we need to have something in temple which reminds us of this. That's the menorah. But we don't stop there. There's all these designs, flowers and cups and spheres. So the creator gave us a design in the menorah which is really a map to the universe. What do I mean? I mean that if you look at the universe, there are categories of creation. You have the raw matter, physical matter. Then you have, now everything looks different. So matter is not all the same in terms of its form. So form is a secondary element of matter. However, we don't have a static universe. There are systems, great systems of weather, and the digestive system, and the circulatory system in man, and how streams are formed, and the propagation of species, that they only produce their own kind, and laws of gravity, and wind, and the universe, and the solar system, and the way we revolve around the sun, and how we rotate on an axis, and the distance between the moon and the earth from the sun. I mean, everywhere there are systems. So if you step back for a second, you look at creation, you look at the universe, what we have is the raw substance, the matter that God created. Number two, we have the forms of matter, different shapes, different trees, rocks, things. We have liquid for water so it can travel inland and reach all different life. In case it only rains in one location, the water can still reach other places. And we have topography. The elevation of mountains creates valleys, and that's the channels through which the streams and rivers and move towards other areas that need water. All right, so that's form. You have matter, you have form, but you also have the function. You have the design of how the whole universe operates, the systems. What do you have in them, Nora? You have a ball, a shapeless entity. All right, that's matter. Then you have flowers. Flowers are form. Now that's a form matter. A flower is a beautiful thing. All right? When we think about beauty in the universe, we think about flowers. Think about something which is its amazing form and its properties, different colors. People love to walk through gardens, right? So that is a very, it's an iconic, it's an icon for how things are formed. But what you have the most instances of on the menorah are the cups. What's a cup? How is a cup different than a flower and just raw matter? What's the difference between a cup as opposed to a flower or just raw substance? Think about this. And again, that's the most instances on the menorah. No, I wouldn't say nutrition. You can get nutrition without any type of a cup. I would say the difference is that a cup... Okay, JM, again, you're batting 1,000 tonight. A container that can hold something for us to use. There's a use, there's a function. A cup is made for use. It's a function. That means that we have... If we look at now, the menorah is supposed to give us insight. What's the insight that gives us? There's a creator. He rested on the seventh day. The branches are all dependent upon that seventh day, meaning all six branches, all 6 days depend on God's will. A very important lesson here is that God controls nature. Without that knowledge, we can't say that he can do miracles. So another lesson we get from understanding that nature, the physical world, is subordinate to God's will, is that the physical world is not absolute. It depends on the God who rested on the Sabbath. That means he can change his will at any time and make a miracle. He could split the Red Sea. He could form a sapphire, two tablets with writing on the inside that grew naturally, the tablets, the Ten Commandments. An amazing thing that must have been to see the tablets. Imagine seeing a rock that's translucent. And the rabbis say that the tablets were sapphire. And if you look on the screen now and open up that link into another image, you'll see a depiction that we put together of what possibly the tablets look like. But how could you get writing on the inside of a stone? That's impossible. And the writing has intelligent sentences that gives 10 commands. That was the most amazing thing that the Jews had ever seen until Moses broke them, because he was afraid, like Rabbi Shade said, that they would deify the tablets just like they deified the golden calf. So when Moses saw the golden calf, he broke the tablets and they shouldn't worship it. And God said he was right. But what that does, when you have tablets and you have writing on the inside of tablets, of a stone, writing on the inside of a natural thing, how did the writing get there? It had a form naturally. That means the creator of the stone, of the tablet, of the sapphire rock, God, is the same God that gave the Torah that's inside those letters. What a stupendous sight that must have been. But that was the lesson of the tablets. The lesson was that the God of the universe, of the physical world, is also the God of Torah. The mistake that the atheist scientists make. So that must have been amazing, that they saw that the Creator had also given the Torah. They knew it was one and the same. Okay, getting back to the menorah. So again, we have raw substance, which is the spheres on the menorah. We have form, which is flowers. But then you have the cups, which is function. Meaning like this, and the cups are the majority of the designs. Meaning that the knowledge man can gain from studying the universe, he can gain from looking at the raw substance. So God puts that on the menorah, because the menorah is representing the creation. So man can study matter and the properties of iron and copper and wood and water and helium and so on. He's going to gain a tremendous amount of appreciation for God. Then he can also look at the form, which is represented by a flower, and to understand why God designed certain things a certain way. The trees have branches and they have leaves. It provides shelter for the birds. It's a method by which the moisture can travel through the trunk and go up and share it with all the leaves. And then the design of water, we said before, so it can travel inland and nutrify all things that need moisture. So that's another area that we could study, is the design of the universe. But where do we get the most impression of God as a designer? Function. how the universe operates, the systems. That's the cup. A cup is something which is an icon for something that has a function. There's a system. So now we look at the menorah, and it's not just a candelabrum. It's something which provides light. It illuminates. It gives wisdom. What is that wisdom? It's pure gold, which equates with the pure gold of the angels, which are closely related to wisdom. That's why they're on the ark. Maimonides talks about it. They're connected with knowledge. How do we not have knowledge right now? 2 seconds later, we have an idea. There's a system of angels, of forces that God created. And one of the functions of angels is that it's a system of knowledge. That's how we receive knowledge. A very abstract idea. But that's why the angels are connected with the Torah, because we only get Torah through God and the angels that reach us. What do the prophets see in visions? Angels, meaning that knowledge is through God's emissaries. There are certain metaphysical beings, and they can communicate to man, but it's in a vision. So now we see the light of the menorah, and it illuminates, and we see the concept of creation. But now the creation of the six branches, depending upon the seventh, the 6 days of creation, depend upon God's will. So it's not absolute. God can make miracles. He can control creation. But now we see one further step, and that is that we could study matter. Those are the spheres. We could study form of the universe, but where we get the most impressions, when we look at all the systems, and we are amazed about how the universe operates, and how, like I said earlier, the Earth going around the Sun, and the distance between the Moon and the Earth, and the phases of the Moon, and how the body is designed. And it's endless. But there we see a harmony that really shows a designer. When you see systems that are harmoniously working together and it perpetuates, it creates and perpetuates animal life and plant life and everything that's perfectly needed for these organisms to exist. So the systems, which I'm saying is represented by a cup, something which has a function, a system, that affords man the greatest opportunity in terms of seeing an appreciation for the Creator. Because now he sees a whole design set up. I mean, you can look at a rock. It's nice. It's amazing. There's a lot of knowledge in the rock. But it's static. But when you see how things operate and how Earth had to be solid and water had to be liquid, and you see the systems interacting with each other, doesn't that give you a much greater appreciation? So I believe that's why there are a lot more to emphasize. This is where the areas of knowledge of creation. But they're all on the menorah, because the menorah is about the 6 days, what God created. All right, so another amazing part of the Torah that, again, I recently had the time to go through, and it's just amazing when you start seeing the clues, just like by kosher, and you look at the words, and you read the rabbis, there's so much that you come away with. Okay, all right, so I think we've run out of time. I'll wait and see if there's any other questions or comments before we wrap it up for this evening. So you can type it on screen. And again, if you missed any part, this will be posted in full on the Bible page. So we'll put a link there next to the book. And JM, I got to give it to you tonight. I got to give a hand to you. Really on target. Very good. Very good insight. All right, so wait and see if there's any questions or comments before we wrap it up. My pleasure, JM. All right, there's a lot more in the book, so you could pick up a copy and you'll see. There's also one other book I put out a few years back, Religion of Reason. I've shared in there quite a bit. Talmud, metaphor, and the Torah. I think it'll really be a very big eye-opener. Okay, Chaya, Yoni, my pleasure. Okay, I hope it was enlightening. I'll wish everybody a good evening. And I hope you'd enjoyed. Have a good night to everybody. And thank you for joining the presentation. You're welcome to everybody. All right, have a good night. I'll be signing off.